Good morning. Merry Christmas. It's good to be here with you this morning, this last Sunday of 2018. I hope you're all still feasting and celebrating. And just put away the scales. Just take the batteries right out of them. We went to Edmonton for Christmas and nonstop food over and over. All our families are in the Edmonton area. So between snacking and feasting and everything else, I did accidentally step on the scale, maybe not accidentally, and yeah, bad news, yeah. So I'm glad Barry's calling us to fast in a few weeks, so that's not why we fast, but so as they say, eat, drink, and be merry. For tomorrow, well, never mind. Don't pay attention to what they say. This morning, have you ever been lost? Has anyone ever here been lost? And I don't mean lost as in the, I need to stop and ask for directions, but I'm too stubborn to do that, so I'm just going to keep driving, kind of lost. I mean, someone was supposed to take care of me, and I have no idea where they are, kind of lost. Has anyone been in that category? Yes. Or, to flip it around, have you ever lost someone? This is typically a story for parents, not exclusively. In fact, you increasingly see these days these stories of how seniors with dementia get lost. Some of you with much younger siblings as well, if you're not parents, will have been in this situation too. Or basically just about everyone who's ever volunteered on a grade 6 field trip, right? If you've done that. Well, I still remember how we lost our third child, Amelia, who's here in the front with me. See, she's still here. She's still here. But we went down to Warm Beach, which is where Regent used to host, used to go for their retreat every year. They do a thing called the Lights of Christmas. So they put up over 1 million lights around the camp, and you walk through, and they got different vendors. You can buy beaver tails and hot this and cider and all that sort of stuff. And it's lovely. And so we were down, my brother and his family were down, and we took everyone down there, and the kids were much younger than they are now, and we're walking through the grounds enjoying these million lights and eating roasted nuts and having pony rides and riding this little Christmas train they have, and it was great. And along the way, we saw Frosty the Snowman, too, and which is awesome. The kids loved it. And it wasn't until halfway, though, through the petting zoo that I asked the question, where's Amelia? Where's Amelia? And then everyone said, oh, she's up with my brother and stuff. So I went to my brother, where's Amelia? I haven't seen her. You know, and so you ask Karen, you ask the aunt, you ask the older kids. No one knows where she is. So that question obviously turned into 10 minutes of sheer panic. And we realized she wasn't with us. She wasn't with the kids. She wasn't with the in-laws. She wasn't anywhere around. And I am a person with a bit of anxiety in my life, historically. And so I tend to overreact. And the only person I know that's worse than me is my brother. And so with great anxiety, we fanned out across this camp looking for her, each carrying one or two younger kids in tow with us, only to find her three exhibits back playing with Frosty the Snowman, who she thought was fantastic. And for the rest of the time, she got to enjoy a very close relationship with her father. And And I enjoyed not having a cardiac arrest event. So it's a funny story in hindsight, but it's terrifying, isn't it, when you're in the middle of it, right? Being lost or losing someone is a terrible experience. In that space, between the fear of what could happen and the relief that it didn't actually happen. Well, this morning, we're going to look at a story about how Jesus was lost. Not that Jesus himself was lost. He knew exactly where he was. But Mary and Joseph did not. And into the situation of panic, anxiety, and stress, Jesus speaks the very first words in Luke's gospel, words which reveal something about who Jesus is and what his priorities are, and it speaks to something about who we are and who we're called to be. So let's read this story. Luke 2, 40 to 52. I actually added a verse. I added 4 at the beginning because it's kind of a bookender. You'll see why later. Verse 40 is the last verse of the previous section where Mary and Joseph had taken him to be, after he was circumcised, taken him to the temple. And the child grew and became strong, and he was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was on him. this new story. Every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up to the festival according to the custom. After the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. But they were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day. Then they began looking for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." "Why were you searching for me?" he asked. "Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Then he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Let's pray. Jesus, we ask for your presence here this morning to lead us into a deeper understanding of these questions of who you are, and these questions as well of who am I, and to see how they're related. How are we related to you, Jesus, and who are you calling us to be? So we ask for your work in our hearts and our souls to draw us into these questions, to reveal more of yourself, we pray. Amen. You know, this story starts out simply enough. Mary and Joseph, notice, they go up every year to the Passover festival. They obey the law and follow the customs, attend the festivals, even when it's difficult. They don't live close to Jerusalem. They're in no suburb. Nazareth is about 80 miles away. It's about a 4-day journey by foot. You probably didn't know this, but only men were actually obligated to go to the festival. Women were not. And many men even, particularly when you live that far away, only went to one festival a year. Ideally, you went to three, but the custom became that only one a year was fine. And even then, the poor didn't usually go. They didn't have the resources. It takes a fair bit of resources, right, to walk for 4 days. It's a lot of food, supplies, plus staying in Jerusalem. It's an 8-day festival if you stay for the whole thing. Even then, not many people even did that. But Mary and Joseph are not ordinary Jews. They are exceptional. That's one of the things this text is telling us. They are extremely pious. They are very, very faithful. They are wholehearted in their obedience to God. And they have an exceptional child whose birth story has filled the beginnings of Luke already. But in this little blink between those two verses we read at the beginning, 12 years have passed. 12 years since those original yet extraordinary events that were narrated in the beginning of Luke that we've sung about this morning, that we've heard about throughout this month of December. Mary and Joseph's piety has not changed in those years. They're as pious as ever, but their lives have calmed down. They become more ordinary, more original in its routine, until this Passover. For this trip started, like all their other trips, the long journey with friends and family, the extended stay in Jerusalem for the entire festival. Jerusalem's bustling with pilgrims at this time, crowded to 8 times its normal size. It's kind of like vacationing in Osoyoos in July and then visiting in December. With lots of feasting and celebration and worship in the temple. But on their way back at the end of the first day, everything changes. It all falls apart. Thinking Jesus was with friends or family hanging out somewhere in the caravan, they didn't notice anything amiss all day long. But when they set up the family tent, Jesus was nowhere to be found. He was missing. Somewhere between Jerusalem and the 25 miles they walked that day, they lost Jesus. they lost their miraculous, wonderful boy. He was missing. First thing in the morning, both Mary and Joseph went as fast as they could back to Jerusalem, hoping for the best, but probably, like most parents, fearing the worst. Terrible things had happened before around Jesus, right? 12 years earlier, an entire town full of children had been massacred by Herod, a massacre which they narrowly escaped. And you never knew what would happen around Jesus. And so they searched, and they searched, and they searched all the way through the city, checking in on friends, relatives, retracing their steps. Where could Jesus be? Until they came to the temple, where, it turns out, Jesus was not anxious at all. He wasn't concerned. In fact, he was busy studying. He was an ideal student. He was active. He was engaged. He was an amazingly insightful and perceptive student. Jesus was among the best of Israel's teachers in the temple, absorbing their instruction, questioning their applications, asking clarifying questions. Jesus, at 12 years old, was sharp, showing wisdom, insight, understanding beyond his years. Jesus is smart. You ever thought about that? How many times do you apply that to Jesus? Jesus is intelligent. People are impressed and amazed by this very intelligent 12-year-old boy from Nazareth. Right? Nazareth is not a big city. It's a small town, backwoods place. Well, Mary can't believe it. I mean, they've ran over 25 miles. They have scoured the entire city of Jerusalem. She is in deep anguish and pain. And here Jesus has been sitting and talking for 3 days. This, to a mother, is absolutely not acceptable. And so she asks, "Why have you treated us this way? We've been so very worried. We've looked for you everywhere." You know, up till now in this story, it's all been about Mary and Joseph, their story with Jesus. With all sorts of extraordinary events, there's been angels and pregnancies and shepherds and magi and prophets and prophetesses. But now Jesus speaks. For the very first time, Jesus says something. His first words are to his own parents. But they are not about his parents. These words are about himself. "Why were you searching for me?" 12-year-old Jesus asks. "Didn't you know? Didn't you know I had to be in my Father's house?" Jesus says to Mary and Joseph. Jesus, this perceptive student who has amazed the top teachers in Israel, has not made a mistake in what he said. He didn't forget what day it was. He didn't get so caught up in his studies that he missed his alarm. He was exactly where he needed to be. The best place in Israel to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength was the temple. In fact, Jesus was home in the house of his Father, learning about his Father and what it meant to be in right relationship with him. You know, like any child in a good home growing up to maturity, he wanted to be with his dad. He was where he needed to be to know his Father and to be equipped for the calling his Father had on his life. But no one understood that. No one in the story. Not his parents, not the teachers, and later, not the disciples or the religious leaders or the Romans. The wisest person in that room that day was a 12-year-old boy. And no one understood what he was saying about who he was and what he was called to do. You know, this is only the first experience Jesus will have about being misunderstood. It will not be the last. And yet this growing, but still vulnerable youth, who has just experienced disappointment with his parents for their lack of understanding. You know, it's not obvious. I think we can read this text and Jesus' words as if Jesus is being snarky. I'd caution against that. Jesus is not snapping back here. I think read these words of Jesus as Jesus being genuinely puzzled. Didn't you know me better than that? Didn't you know me? Jesus does not explode in anger at his disappointment with his parents. He doesn't run away exclaiming, "No one understands me," right? We've all, well, maybe not all of us. I've done that before. He doesn't, and this is one thing that I think maybe we've all done at some point in our life, he doesn't condescendingly talk down to his parents. You ever put your parents in their place? Has anyone ever done that? But Jesus simply, with humility, lives with these unmet expectations and returns to Nazareth with his parents. Jesus is obedient every step of the way. Even though he was unknown, in spite of everything, in spite of all that had happened, unknown by his own parents, by those closest to him. You know, his mother might not have understood, but she didn't forget. She wondered, she pondered, and she prayed as Jesus continued to grow up. And Jesus did grow up. He grew up physically, grew up emotionally, grew up intellectually. And he became a wise man, one who had a good reputation in his community, a good reputation with God himself, with his father. You know, for sure, this is an unusual story, right? Jesus is different, isn't he? I don't know that many 12-year-olds who are debating theology in the atrium at Regent College. But when we slow down like this, this is what I'm trying to do, to slow down and take a look at this story, Jesus isn't that different, is he? Is his experience that different? He has a life, right? He has family and friends, traditions and habits. He has a community around him. He's growing up. He has these tensions between who other people think he is and who he understands himself to be. And he is misunderstood. Just when he does that thing in which he has to do it, it's so central to his life and calling, he is accused at that very point of mistreating those that he loves. You know, many of us have stories like this, don't we, in our past, in our background. When you disappointed your parents, or maybe even a single parent, your father or mother. When you played piano instead of hockey, more of a Canadian issue. Soccer instead of dance, maybe. Became a teacher instead of an engineer. Studied philosophy instead of law. You felt misunderstood. You felt unknown. You know, Hebrews talks about how Jesus experienced our temptations, how he learned obedience through his sufferings. And at 12 years old, Jesus was not rejected. That would come later. But he did experience in his very own life those human experiences in some of our most vulnerable years. Experiences of not being known, of not being heard, of not being seen. Jesus was the Son of God. But all people could see was a very human, albeit very gifted, 12-year-old boy. Which was true, just not the whole truth. So which raises the question for us, who is Jesus? You know, in this story, he seems to be too human to be the Son of God. And in other stories, he seems too powerful to be human. And this has always been a tension for those of us considering who Jesus is. You know, very early, there were people who tried to resolve this tension with Jesus, one way or another. One very early and very famous attempt is called the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. Has anyone read that? No? You're going to love this. This is one of those gospels that sometimes gets claimed has been pushed out by these early church leaders, right? There's lots of Gospels. Why are there only four in our Bible? This one tells a lot of stories about Jesus' childhood. So stories like this. So remember the time when Jesus breaks the Sabbath by making model birds out of mud, but he gets out of trouble by making them fly away before anyone notices. Or the time that Jesus curses the son of Annas because he spoiled Jesus' game. And the boy withers up. Yeah. A boy bumps into Jesus, who curses him, and then he dies. Yeah. Not likely to make it in your children's story. Jesus is sent to school, and he humiliates the teacher by baffling him with allegorical imagery. Right? One of Jesus' playmates is killed falling from a building. And Jesus is blamed for this event, but he's exonerated because he raises the child to life again. A pitcher is broken, a pitcher of water, and so Jesus just scoops up his coat and carries the water anyway. Jesus cuts Joseph this time at home, this is Jesus at home, cuts a piece of lumber, the wrong size as you get, right? You get the measurements wrong, so Jesus just stretches it to fit. A teacher slaps Jesus for answering him back. He was snarky this time. Well, the teacher is cursed by Jesus and he collapses. But quickly, another third teacher praises Jesus' wisdom. And so then Jesus relents and is pacified. He heals the other teacher. And then people comment that this child is not earthborn. And this infancy gospel actually finishes with the very text that we're looking at, Luke 2, 41 to 52, a slightly expanded version of this story here. So, you know, this text is probably from 2nd or 3rd century, but here's a very early, speculative, somehow Christian community connected, not very faithful to the text, but, you know, a very creative imagining of what Jesus' early life could be like. Obviously, this one falls firmly on the side of he's obviously divine, special, not earthborn kind of child, and the stories are ridiculous. It's pretty obvious to all of us, I think, when I talk about these stories in this gospel, why it's been called in the past the Gospel of the Super Brat. That's what one scholar called it. So, and there's good reasons, obviously, why this so-called gospel is not in our Bible. That has no historical basis whatsoever. But it's amusing to us. But the question remains, who is Jesus? And that's a question of identity. Now, identity in our culture is a live question, isn't it? Particularly so now, and increasingly so. You know, there seems to be increasing confusion as the options expand, and these days, seemingly exponentially. And they'll continue to expand. I mean, identity questions are not going to go away as long as we continue down the road of individualism. Right? If we primarily relate who we are to what we desire, or to what we do, or to what we have, or even to who we know, or, the more basic one, to what makes me happy, the options for identity keep proliferating. Because the operative word in each of those cases is me, or we. And desires just go all over the map. There's no end to them. You know, the good news that Jesus offers in his gospel is that we don't have to take that road. We can, and we should. Part of the call of the church to follow Jesus is to give up that kind of identity, that self-centered identity. That is not the path to life. And we see this right from the beginning, right? That's part of our story, the biblical story, right from the beginning with that fateful choice at that fateful tree, that choosing our own desires leads to death. In fact, more than one death, right? Death in our relationships. We see that fracturing between Adam and Eve, that fracturing in the relationship with God, that fracturing in their vocation, right? Even their work with the earth is broken. And eventually it leads to our own death. We're called to a different type of identity as Christians, a relational identity, being rightly related to God and to each other. Jesus summed this up once as the great commandment. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's core to who we are. It's a very different path to identity than the one the culture's on. That's the difference between what are my desires? To answer the question, who am I in relationship with? It's a very different question. What are my desires on the one hand to define who I am? To instead ask, who am I in relationship with? And how can I faithfully love them? And yet, it's different from our culture, but it's not simple. That's one of the things I love about this story, and one I think that's encouraging for us. Because this story reveals that a growing, developing, maturing Jesus had to wrestle with questions of identity that were complex, even in these basic questions of who am I? Now, Jesus was growing and maturing in his identity as a son of Yahweh, to the point where nothing could be more appropriate and natural than for him to be in his father's house, discussing his father's law, growing in his wisdom about how to be in right relationship with the father and with each other. Because after all, that's the purpose of the law. And yet, right into the middle of this growing relationship with Yahweh, a growth in zeal and wisdom and an understanding, the kind of growth his own parents have modeled with their diligent piety, with their faithful observance of the law, there's a serious tension. Whose child is Jesus? That's the question which has caused so much distress in this story, so much worry, so much anxiety for Mary and Joseph. Jesus was in his father's house, but he caused a lot of pain because he was not in his father's tent. So I want us to see in this story that even for Jesus, identity is complex. Even for Jesus, it's filled with tensions and competitions, needing wisdom and active submission. It's hard to submit. All these questions pop up. To whom do I submit? When do I submit? How do I submit? In the midst of so many choices in our lives. You know, Jesus ends up resolving the situation with his own submission to his earthly parents. Not because he has to, but because he chooses to. And we don't hear from Jesus again after these verses for over 15 years. It's implied here that he faithfully lives in this tension for a long, long time, continuing to grow in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. Jesus has lived in his own life the tensions of identity, the tension between being faithful to God and faithful to those other relationships, to our parents, to our employer, to our friends, to our vocations. He gets our struggle. Jesus has been there himself. You know, being a follower of Jesus doesn't make identity questions go away. Being a follower of Jesus doesn't resolve all those tensions. It doesn't make the questions of who am I in my relationships with others? Who am I in my relationships with others? And how can I love and bless them? Simple and clear. We see this at Christmas often, don't we? Sometimes when we go back to visit our families, we've got our relationship with Jesus that's primary. And yet we can go back to families in which, you know how you go back to your family, you know, technically it's always called family of origin. You know how you slot right into those emotional patterns? You know, all of a sudden, you know, my kids even comment, "Dad, you're getting really loud." It's, you know, not usually like that, right? And then you're with the other family and all of a sudden, "Dad, you're not saying anything." Right? You have different roles in different families. That's how it works. And you see this at Christmas, don't you? But you also often have that tear in your heart where you're like, I wish that we were all seeking to be faithful to Jesus and to love and bless one another. But that's not usually what's happening in our extended families, is it? Or with our extended friendships, or in our workplaces, or in other places where God has called us to. There's tensions there. Well, Jesus has lived these tensions. He gets our struggle. He has been there. Being a follower of Jesus will help, though, realign these foundational questions in a way that helps us live well. You know, I think we see this kind of alignment all the way through the New Testament, and I think we see it even in the short story. You know, obviously our first relationship is to the Lord. That's who we're called to. Everything relates to the triune God. This is foundation for everything else in our lives. Our lives really are hidden with Christ and God. And most of us spend our entire Christian walk trying to, in faith, actually believe that. There's nothing you can't do that God has called you to do if you truly believe that your life is hidden with Christ and God. The text that Judy read, right? Height and depth of God's love. That's what your experience would be. We have to claim that by faith. That's our primary relationship. We are called to faith in Jesus Christ. We are made alive with his Spirit. We are invited into the most intimate places of the Father's house. It says in the book of Hebrews, we can come boldly into the Holy of Holies before the throne. We are redeemed. We are sinners made saints by God's generous, gracious love. Amen. But that's not the end of identity, is it? Because we have other relationships. Our other relationships, and they are many, have the character of blessing and service and submission when they take their rightful place under our relationship to the Lord. And yes, I did say the word submission. I know that's a hard word to hear in our culture, and it's one that we should use carefully, because I'm not talking about the demanding, I'm not worthy, abusive kind of submission. I am talking about the kind Jesus shows here, the voluntary, loving, serving, seeking the best kind of submission. This is the kind of life that we're invited into in this story. This is the kind of life that we can take Jesus' own life and pattern our lives on it. This is the kind of life that seems so risky, so vulnerable, but it is so revolutionary in a world that is hungry for power and for control and for self-definition. This kind of life can change the world, and already has. And by God's grace and by his Spirit, it still is. Right here in Vancouver, we are changing the world and our relationships with each other and with those outside this church. Vancouver, I get, often feels like ground zero for these identity questions, doesn't it? An identity grounded on desire, on happiness, and on the self. But we can witness to a better way. We can witness to a different way. You know, Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount is a good start. This life of submission, I think, is seen through the New Testament in all sorts of ways. So the Sermon on the Mount's a good start. You can just look at, I mean, there's lots of examples in there, but just look at Jesus' instruction on how to treat enemies, right? The whole turn the other cheek. Think about Paul's instructions in Ephesians about how husbands and wives relate to each other. Think about the slavery-destroying letter to Philemon that doesn't outright condemn slavery, but now makes the slave the brother and asks the slave master to submit to Paul. Think about the foundational importance of loving obedience that we see all the way through the Gospel of John, all the way through John's letters, and even into the book of Revelation. Think about the radical call all the way through the New Testament when it touches on these various relationships, about the kind of identities we're called to in which we can choose to serve, in which we can choose to bless, in which we can even, when appropriate, submit. We're in danger sometimes of a kind of dreamy spiritual romanticism, some kind of la-la land, right? We'll follow Jesus, we'll do that romantic submission thing, and everything will be okay. Everything will be happy. Everything will be good. Well, that's not how it actually works. It's not actually how it worked in Jesus' life, if you read through the end of these Gospels. So there will be questions we will have more and more tensions and questions as we follow this path of Jesus about how to relate our relationship to the Lord with the, let's be honest, the very uncomfortable, sin-sick, not the way it's supposed to be kinds of relationships that we have in this world. But I want to show you this morning that you are not alone in those questions. You are not alone in those tensions. Jesus has been there himself. We have Jesus' word and spirit to help us, to guide us, to strengthen us, and to empower us to live a life with that kind of character that can orient ourselves towards love. I haven't really said that word love yet, but that's loving is just summing up all this kind of service and blessing. It's an act and life of love. You know, at its best, when we live this way, the world will see our lives of blessing and service. At best, they see it as a mystery. A mystery that blesses them sometimes, but a mystery nonetheless. They're often in that place of Mary. They do not understand it. And at worst, let's be honest, as you can see right now in some of the ways the church is being persecuted in China, they will see that kind of life as a threat, as a challenge and a threat, because there's an allegiance going on there that is higher than the state. You know, at the end of today's story, even Jesus' mother didn't understand. And yet she didn't shy away from these questions. She pondered them, she reflected on them, she stored them in her heart. She didn't let them go. You know, I want to see, though, even though Mary didn't understand, she showed up at the end of the story, at the foot of the cross. I think that's where it all came home to her, all these questions, at the foot of the cross. And then Mary shows up also at the beginning of Acts as the church is being born. And she's fully on board with this new mission of Jesus by the Spirit, because everything is possible when your life is hidden with Christ and God. The Spirit is poured out, and nothing can hold you back when you have God's own life willing to raise the dead. Hallelujah, hallelujah indeed. So this morning, you're invited into a new kind of life. I want to invite you into 2019 in a different kind of life as a church. And I want you to choose it, though, right? Jesus gives us lots and lots of power. This is not slavery in the sense of it's imposed on you. This is offered to you, this kind of life. Notice that even in this story, Jesus wasn't dragged by his mother back to Nazareth. In fact, if you read this story, all the active verbs, you know, all the subjects of the action in the sentences, it's almost always Mary and Joseph all the way through the story. And then those last couple of verses, it switches to Jesus. Jesus chooses to go to Nazareth. Jesus has agency. Jesus is choosing to be in right relationship with his parents. Notice that submission does not mean slavery. Follow the arc of the story. Jesus offers you a choice. So I don't know where you are this morning with these two important questions. The questions of who is Jesus? Who am I? And it's a natural time to consider those questions, I think, as we look into a new year. As we consider who we were this past year and who we want to be in the future. But this year, I do want to invite you, as we close, to consider this second question. Consider the who am I question in light of the who is Jesus question, and discover how Jesus can reframe everything, right? It might just be the case that the question of who is Jesus is the most important, the most life-changing, the most revolutionary question in the entire world. And it's okay if you find yourself in different places here with those questions. You might find yourself like Mary. You might find yourself not quite understanding who Jesus is, but considering him, pondering him, pondering the evidence, exploring who he might be, open to the possibilities that Jesus just might be more than you had ever considered before. Well, I want to invite you here this next year to hang out with us. You're welcome to bring your questions to this place. We're exploring them together. We're looking at who Jesus is in this church. We would love to explore these questions with you. But you might also find yourself as a follower of Jesus in a place like Jesus. You might be increasingly growing in your relationship with God. You might be rooting your identity in a deeper way in God's redemption story as one who's been saved by grace. But you might be finding yourself on that journey towards God in a deeper way, being misunderstood, even by those closest to you, those you thought would be most supportive of this change of identity from being self-focused to being God-related. Or you might be in the midst of tensions between your commitment to Jesus and relating faithfully to your family, your friends, your work. You might be in a place of frustration, of not being able to please everybody. And you need God's grace and wisdom to live in that tension of loving God and loving others.